Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're here today to talk about Season 2, Episode 9, titled Blackwater, one of my all-time favorite Game of Thrones episodes. I really love this one.
Yeah, it's good. It holds up like a champ.
Yeah. I love the bravery of Tyrion in it. I actually really like some of the scenes with Cersei. I think it has a really surprising and awesome finale. Or final scene, I guess. And yeah, it's just great all around. I don't know how much more I want to say about it before we get to the recap, but you got any thoughts?
I agree to completely. I think that not only is it action-packed, not only does it have so much spectacle, but it also gives important glimpses into what motivates people that previously have been somewhat of enigmas or just pure villains, like the Hound. Mm-hmm. You know, and this season's been good for his development because we've seen that there's more to him than initially met the eye. It also, like, you know, it challenges you kind of like what side you're on, too, because there are good men that we care about in both this. Like, regardless of how you feel about Stannis, like, I've always mm-hmm. been a Davos fan.
Yeah.
And he's got a son who, you know, depending on your point of view, is deluded or a true believer, but he's certainly not an evil person. And then, of course, we like Tyrion, but we hate Joffrey and Cersei, and we like Sansa, and maybe we're conflicted about Shay, but she probably shouldn't die or be raped. There's stakes on each side, and... And, you know, I feel like that there's a nice rhythm where you think that King's Landing is doomed, and then King's Landing is maybe saved because of wildfire, and then mm-hmm. Stannis pigheadedly presses the attack and everything going his way, and then the ghost of Renly rides and drives him back. It's good. It feels like it's a longer episode than an hour, but in like a really good way. Mm-hmm. Not like, oh my God, this is a dragon, just like, oh, I can't believe how much stuff has been packed into this episode.
Yeah, and the tension is there in spades. And as someone who hasn't read the books, when I first saw this episode, I legitimately thought, okay, they've done enough to where I think this story could survive the fall of King's Landing and Stannis right. becoming king, because I think there are vendettas there. I think, you know, the death of Renly could be something that Brienne wants to try to avenge, right? And that Catelyn might help her in. I think there are reasons for the story to continue, even if all the Lannisters are killed in this scene mm-hmm. or in this episode. So for me, it was a very tense episode led by a lot of characters that I care about.
Right.
Davos and Tyrion being among the most cared for.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should get into the recap now.
Yeah, let's do it. Hey, everybody, before we get to the main content, we want to talk about stuff going on here at Bald Move, a little thing we like to call Keeping of the House. We have got full coverage of Mr. Robot Season 3 in full swing. I'm really digging that season, Jim.
Yeah.
We also have full coverage of Walking Dead Season 8. And
not digging that
and
one
it,
quite
it,
as much.
It is coverage. It is coverage of the season. It
sure is.
If you are slightly to moderately to very disappointed at the way The Walking Dead is going, I highly encourage you to check out our podcast. If you really are happy, then you don't want to borrow that trouble. Mm. Cecily and I are holding down the fort over at American Horror Story. We've got, last week we saw Thor Ragnarok and enjoyed ourselves. We got the spoiler-free version for everybody, the spoiler-filled version for club members only. We're going to be doing the same thing this week for Murder on the Orient Express. As always, we have lunch with Jim and Aaron. We also recorded a little commissioned podcast, down at the Rocket City NerdCon, live in front of a studio audience. Little indie film called Return of the Jedi. It's loosely based on the work of Akira Kurosawa here. It's a very scholarly mm-hmm. take of the film. And you can check that out. It'll be released probably Thursday or maybe Friday this week.
Yeah.
That's what we got going on at baldmove.com. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
We start off with Stannis' fleet arriving at King's Landing. Davos' son seems pretty confident about their victory prospects due to his faith in a lot of things, the Lord of the Light, their cause, their captain. Davos is a little more concerned, though. He's got some reservations.
It is nice, I guess, that Stannis kept his word to Davos about Melisandre. She is not in evidence in this battle.
She's nowhere to be found.
It's one of the things his hand counseled very strongly against her being there. So, and then Stannis loses. So you already can tell that, I'm inclined to agree with Davos that he shouldn't do dark magic to win the kingship. But on the other hand, you can see how this is going to set up a lot of tension because he listened to Davos, someone that he trusted to give him good advice, and it kind of fucked him over.
Yeah, and I mean, we don't see the fate of Davos in this. We kind of see all of the ships blown up. We see Davos and his son out there at sea. I don't know where he ends up, but Stannis gets kind of pulled from the battle. We can see him being yanked off the battlefield very quickly. This is certainly going to drive him, I think, more toward the Lady of the Light, right? The Lord of the Light.
Yeah.
Because, she warned him and she told him, look, the Lord of the Light is providing all this, and then he left her behind.
Yep.
So it could be interpreted as a mistake by him. So let's move on to Tyrion, who is worried about the battle. He's in his chambers there, and Shay tells him that she's going to keep him safe, which Tyrion knows is just, her being sort of playful and trying to just
pillow talk, baby.
Yeah, pretty much. Tyrion tells her that she doesn't have to be there, but she is adamant that she is going to stay with Tyrion to the very end. I mean, this is foolish, but it's also, I understand, I don't think this is a bad scene with Shay.
No, I
don't
either.
Has made up her mind. She's decided she loves Tyrion, and consequences be damned, she's going to see out both of their fates, intertwined fates.
Totally.
Which, I don't know, later on, the scenes with Shay and Cersei, I'm starting to think, maybe this wasn't such a great idea with what we know about Cersei looking for Tyrion's whores.
Well, it's a good thing Lancel busted in at the right moment, and Cersei was well into her cups, so does she even remember that she almost bloodhounded the identity of Tyrion's secret whore?
Yeah, probably not.
Because the thing is like, I don't even think she knows what she's got here. I think she still believes that Roz was Tyrion's whore, and he's got she's got him waylaid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is just Cersei being, when she interrogates, being petty.
Yeah.
Like, just to make fun of this little poor peasant girl who's trying to pass herself off as a lady. I don't think she has any idea that that there's something sinister afoot.
She doesn't, but I feel like she might accidentally stumble into that information.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
That's definitely the tension we're supposed to be feeling.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, Pycelle comes in to Cersei in the Red Keep and says, hey, here's some Essence of Nightshade. 3 drops will make you shit yourself. 5 drops will turn your guts inside out. I don't know. 10 drops, we don't ever find out. I don't want to know, what does 10 drops do?
I think it's death.
Yeah?
Death by shitting your guts out.
Okay.
Apparently.
Yeah. So just in case she needs to kill herself, she's got the tools to do it.
I just love how delicately he's trying to do this. And then Cersei's just like, just give me the poison. Get the fuck out.
Yeah. She's got no patience for him. Neither do I, frankly. I'm glad she didn't let him tell this story because I was not that interested.
The thing is I do know, and the show has made this explicit, that he's a Lannister man. That he is loyal to Tywin and to the extension House Lannister. He thinks that's good for the realm, maybe, or he definitely thinks that's what side his bread is buttered on. And I am kind of curious what he was actually trying to say. Was he trying to counsel her against committing suicide? Was he trying to like tell her when to commit? Like, she cut him off, but I think he was trying to offer like whatever he considers a word of wisdom. And I was kind of interested to see what he was going to say. But
yeah, don't forget, he's not supposed to be on a side in this war, right?
No,
he's supposed to be offering up advice for the Lannisters to win the war or to save themselves or anything like that.
Well, I do think he's supposed to serve the king of the land.
Okay.
I think he's fine doing what he's doing. The original sin was him helping to conspire against the Baratheons and kind of putting his thumb on different scales. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, he's meddling more than he probably should be.
Oh yeah, yeah,
as
yeah,
a maester.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's had a history of doing that. So I just wonder what he was going to say because
we'll never know.
Yeah, I don't know. Like he's the kind of guy that probably wants Cersei to maybe mention him to Tywin when he comes. Like he gave me this word of wisdom, and I was just about to drink the poison. But then he said, you should always tell a long-winded story about wolves and stags and lions before you do so. And that bought me the time you needed to fight your way to the throne room.
Uh-huh.
Maybe. That's how it goes in his head.
Yeah. At the end, she does tell a long-winded story, that buys her the time.
See?
That Tywin needs
that's
to come
that,
in.
That's that leal service that you want from a Grand Maester.
All right, then we go to Bronn and the other Lannister's troops, and they are drinking, they're singing, they're whoring, all in preparation for the battle. The Hound shows up, and he gets all serious about how much he and Bronn both love killing and really changes the mood of the room. And they're ready to fight each other, but the alarm bells sound, and everyone moves to their positions.
Yeah, who wins that fight?
The Hound.
I think so, too. I think Bronn would make a good showing of it.
He would.
But
certainly.
If he thinks the Hound doesn't notice that his hand went to the small of his back, he's fucking crazy.
Yeah, and I think, Bronn does have probably the advantage of speed, but I think Bronn gets in and he tries to slice the Hound's leg, and he gets him, but the Hound gets Bronn and does not let go.
Yeah, if the Hound gets a hold of him or gets a good... I mean, that's the thing,
I saw him cut a man in half.
I don't think that Bronn has no chance. Like, I think that, 7 out of 10 times the Hound wins, maybe 8 out of 10 times. But I do think that, when Bronn says, but I'm quicker, we know Bronn is quick. We know he's sneaky. But I think the only advantage he'd have over the Hound is his quickness, because the Hound's a dirty fighter, too.
Sure.
Hound gives no fucks about honor. He's not a knight. He doesn't give a shit. So I thought that was interesting. And I don't know why the Hound is so damn bloody-minded.
Yeah, he's...
I mean, I know why he's so damn bloody-minded. Because that's just who he is. He's just angry about everything and everyone and anyone that's managed to enjoy life and not carry their conscience and their guilt and their self-loathing. That doesn't get in the way of them whoring and drinking. He kind of instinctively hates.
Yeah, but this is not the moment to take out your anger
It also made me wonder who the hell this little blonde, chubby cheek drinking buddy he's got. Like, this is the Hound's best friend. Like, you know, on the night, it's the night of Eve here, Philip. Uh-huh. It's the eve of war. I want someone to drink with. Like, what is him? Is he a fishing buddy? What do they have in common? This guy doesn't look like he likes killing.
Is that maybe his squire? I don't know. The kid, he looks like a kid. He's just tiny.
I mean,
and
he's not a knight, so I don't know that he's necessarily entitled to a squire.
I'm not sure.
And if someone assigned him to it, I don't think he would take to it kindly. So I just thought
it's
funny
that the Hound had any friends.
I know, they conspicuously walk him in together and sit him down at the same table. Like, I think the Hound should have walked in alone and just sat in a corner table and, like, you know, drunkenly slurred challenges at Braun. It's interesting. And there's this guy's I don't think ever seen before, and he's trying to act like. I mean, he's trying to act like the part. Uh-huh. I don't know.
I think it would be funnier if that guy was sitting at that table and the Hound came in and sat down and just stared at him until he left.
Yeah. I mean, he did do that to that table full of people. Him and his buddy did. But, yeah, I know what you mean. I just feel like this guy should have been bigger and, like, a lot less clean cut.
Yeah.
And a lot more, like, sweaty and maybe scarred and dangerous. This guy is, like, a pretty – man. I don't know. Maybe he's a real motherfucker, and that's why him and the Hound get along.
Maybe.
Oh, is it also like? I think this is the second time we've heard the Reigns of Castamere
in this episode.
No, in the series.
Okay.
Like, they really
play it a lot. Yeah,
they do end up playing a lot. Sorry for the spoiler. The Reigns of Castamere that is so conspicuously displayed in this episode becomes it's the Lannister's greatest hit.
Yeah,
and as they kind of ascend to power. By consolidating their grip on King's Landing and winning this initial battle, you know, that becomes a lot more popular. But yeah, I thought it was good, and I forgot that they had this is the episode where they have the a cappella singing at the end.
Oh yeah,
and it's a little. What do you say? It's not a chilling song. It's a song that gives you chills.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Okay. Yeah, I thought it was an interesting choice, and Game of Thrones does make some surprising choices with its credits music from time to time.
Yeah.
I felt like this was one of them. I wanted maybe something, I don't know, a little more of the era. This didn't really feel like something that would have been, I don't know, around at the time, but...
Why do you say that?
I don't know. I think more of like... you know, drums and some kind of musical accompaniment in the songs of the time.
But I can see Braun.
I suppose, like, you know, minstrels would be out there just singing. And
Braun, in his capacity of the commander of the Gold Cloaks, who's trying to marshal the city's defenses, is trying to bolster them about, like, you know, don't count the Lannisters out because the last house that said, you ain't shit and we don't need to bow and scrape before you got, and mm-hmm. they are no longer around. There is no one left to hear the rains falling on or their halls. So
yeah.
I thought it was appropriate.
Okay.
It is funny because, like, in the Game of Thrones universe, it does seem like there's only essentially two songs. There's, like, the Bear and the Maiden Fair and Reigns of Castamere.
Uh-huh.
So there's just two state. It's like game. It's like Grand Theft Auto, and only there's two radio stations, and they play the same two songs.
All right, let's go to Tyrion having his armor put on by his squire Podrick. Varys gives him a map.
There's an app for King's Landing defense.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Before he had this scene, because this was a pretty good scene. Varys gives him a map of the tunnels of King's Landing. Tyrion says he doesn't want to use the map to escape. Implying that he's going to use it for strategic purposes. Varys tells Tyrion that Stannis is following the Lord of Light, and it would be a terrible thing if he were to sit on the Iron Throne. And he says Tyrion's the only man who can stop him.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things going on in the scene. I like there's some, I guess, witty repartee. Like, Tyrion accuses Varys of being a boy fucker, which I always think is a cheap shot.
Yeah. I mean, I've never seen anything for Varys that would imply that.
I mean, yeah, I don't think he has any weaknesses along those lines. I mean, for one thing, he has no penis nor balls.
Mm-hmm.
And he's never let on that he's got any kind of, like Littlefinger teases him. Like, a lot of people do, but, like, it seems like it's just cheap shots. The other thing is he hints about this hatred he has for dark magic and then says this line about, have I ever told you of my story of how I got cut?
Mm-hmm.
Implying that there's more to that story.
Yep.
But it's another little shade for Varys. He hates magic users.
And he starts it off. He starts off the next sentence with one day, which I think begins a story that he's about to tell. And then he says, "I will."
Yeah,
I was like disappointed because I wanted to hear the
story. A long, long time ago, in a town far, far away.
Yeah,
a guy cut my balls and penis off. The end.
That
was a story. Yeah,
not as good as I was hoping.
Varys, he never says he's a master of whispers, not storytelling.
Yeah. Okay, Davos hears the bells and he starts a sick drum beat of his own to combat.
Those drums are badass.
Like playing dueling banjos here, except dueling bells and drums. Yeah, the drums work not just for the men and the troops, but also for the audience. You know, it gets the audience pumped, too. I certainly was.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Tyrion reminds Bronn of the plan as they bid each other good luck in battle. Tyrion sees Sansa coming into the throne room to see Joffrey, and Joffrey makes Sansa kiss his new sword, Heart Eater. Sansa makes some veiled insults, which doesn't really sit well with Joffrey, but he's got other things to do, so he can't, like, punish her in the moment.
Yeah, Sansa's really pushing it, and I guess what I've understood after I've watched this, I don't know how many times I've seen this episode, and I've already done at least two podcasts on it before.
Uh-huh.
I feel like that Sansa understands that this is a good thing for her. If she survives the sack of King's Landing, you know, her father thought highly of Stannis. You know, Stannis can hardly be worse than Joffrey. It's not like she's done anything wrong. I really feel like she's got a sincere belief that this is her ticket out of here. And I don't think, you know, this is before Sansa starts laying down the law about, like, you know, how everybody gets raped and pillaged and burnt. But I think that's her sincere belief. So that's why she's extra insolent, because she doesn't expect Joffrey to survive and she expects herself to be vindicated. And this is kind of first real strong resistance to Joffrey that hasn't been, like, under her breath or, like, something that she's...
It's Joffrey's still veiled, but...
It's veiled, but it's, like, her attitude is betraying it more.
Yeah.
And, like you said, Joff understands the insult, can't quite pinpoint where it's hitting him because she's saying the right things.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, he also doesn't have time to fuck with her right now.
Right.
I love the dialogue between Bronn and Tyrion. Like, there's some of this stuff is in the book, but I know a lot of it is kind of show only. They really, the chemistry between Bronn and Tyrion is such on screen that I know the Double D's kind of leaned into that. And I like the idea of, Tyrion calling him friend, and Bronn's like, "Oh, we friends now." He's like, "Well, just because I don't pay you money for your services doesn't make us friends." He's like, "Or doesn't make us not friends." Because it enhances the friendship.
Enhances. That's a fancy word. I've been hanging out with fancy lads.
It's great. It's great pre-battle patter, and
for sure,
they deliver it well.
Yeah, one of my favorite pairings, Tyrion and Bronn. Let's move on to the Wall. Joffrey's questioning Tyrion's plans when he doesn't see any of their ships in the bay, and Tyrion dismisses him with kind of, I don't know, he's got some insults of his own. He's very dismissive here. Davos also notices that there are no ships in the bay, and he wonders what the hell's up with that. I don't feel like his son ever gets what's happening here.
No, because his son is filtering everything through the prism of the Lord of Light has foreseen this victory and our victory is assured. Where Davos was like,
thinking, oh, there was discontent among the ranks and maybe the ship's pieced out.
Right. Like, I don't know how the Lord of Light's going to give us this battle, but he's going to give us a battle and this might be.
And he's looking for signs. Yeah.
Right, right. And whereas Davos is looking like where they can get fucked. And honestly, it seemed like to be the only one, because I don't even detect, like, any kind of wariness from Stannis, which I found surprising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Stannis is obviously sort of hanging back. So I don't know how much information he has at any given time, because he's pretty far back there, because when the wildfire goes off,
right,
his
he's out of
ship
range.
is preserved. So then we see Cersei giving Sansa some wine. Sansa notices Illyn Payne in the room. Cersei explains that he's there for their protection. And then someone comes in with a report about stealing horses, and Cersei says to put those people's heads on spikes, and Illyn Payne goes to do just that, which Sansa notices, and she's a little concerned by it.
Mm-hmm.
Cersei, in this scene, is wearing like video game armor, like the kind of armor that doesn't actually cover anything or protect you from anything. I don't know what good a metal corset does you if Stannis busts into that room with 60 of his dudes.
It doesn't, but it kind of I think underlines her statements about how hollow a woman's courage is allowed to be in this world. Mm-hmm. You know, like, yeah. If I was my brother, I would have been trained to have a sword and I might be able to do something this sense. But here, I'm just here. This is what is expected of me. I'm supposed to be courageous and strong and bold. And look here, I got my gold tits out. And I think you're supposed to recognize how silly and ridiculous it is. Mm-hmm. This is the Lannister idea of how to arm a woman.
Yeah, and the wine is definitely helping her with all that courageous, bold stuff.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I don't think any of the hens are going to be crowing about how you helped them out on this one, Cersei. Sorry, I don't think it's going to happen.
They might go back and say, I mean, she hardly seemed to even notice that there was a battle, but she was very, very drunk, mm-hmm. though.
Yeah, and she's just so saucy. I love how Lena Headey plays her, and she's forcing Sansa to drink, and she's like disgusted that Sansa is still the thing that she wishes she could be, but that's not even true because she wishes she was a man at this point. It's like there's just a lot of layers to her pathos, and that you see scenes like this, and you kind of understand where she's coming from, and you start to feel a little bit sorry for her,
and you get that sense of impending doom in these scenes with Cersei. I think it's really well cut, this episode. Mm-hmm. This episode is very well edited because you're cutting between the battle and the threat, and then Cersei's in this hole of keep, where she's hoping that the forces her city has will be enough to do the job, and if not, she has no hope herself of stopping them.
The rhythm is such that the way they do the editing is that as the episode gets bigger and bigger in terms of spectacle and war and gore, the editing is they cycle around all the characters faster and faster, and you get this mm-hmm. sensation of like you're watching like a plate spinning thing, and everything's getting more intense, and like you got to get around and spin the plates faster and faster, and it gives you this real sense of urgency. And kind of keeps you off base, and you can't really tell, who's going to win or lose until the very end. And mm-hmm. it's really great filmmaking.
All right, so we go to Stannis ships entering the bay. A single Lannister ship goes out to meet them, and Davos sees that it's empty and it's spreading wildfire through the bay. It's too late, and with a single arrow, Bronn ignites the wildfire, taking out a huge portion of Stannis' fleet. Stannis commands the remaining fleet to land on the shores.
Once again, this is, I think, the final scene that Roy Dotrice, rest in peace, was ever in, but he really had a lot of fun being a pyromancer, just with his old man.
Lighting up that torch.
His old man glee, and like he was like one of the few ones besides Joffrey who reacted positively to the effects of the substance.
Yeah, this is like a guy who, you know, designs and builds robots for a living, seeing one turned on for the first time.
Right, and it's rampaging through the city.
I made all this wildfire. I want to see it in action.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Here's the flame, my lord. and he almost clips the Hound with it, which kind of scares the Hound. And then you can see when the wildfire goes up, the Hound's face, there's a look of almost sorrow for the people who are burning.
Yeah, you know? and a deep primal animal level fear. And you saw that like Tyrion kind of like even Bronn kind of disgusted at just the wholesale instant pitiless merciless carnage that they've unleashed with one stroke. And like I said, Joff is kind of like thrilling to it, and the pyromancer, but everybody else is and the explosion itself is just so cool.
It's very impressive
and awesome, and kind of like the Old Testament kind of way, and the sound that makes of like the air being sucked out and the men screaming, it's terrible.
Yeah, it has a real concussive force to it, you know.
Yeah,
it's not just the ship went up in flames.
Right.
It's got a lot of pressure behind it too.
And then as everybody's kind of staggered and reeling and, like, frankly shitting their pants about this, Stannis stands up and says, nope, we're still alive, we still got men, we're going to take this city. And his sub-commander is like, but my lord, hundreds will die. And he's like, thousands. So you can just see that Stannis is all in. He does not care what the cost is. this is the chance. He's not going to get another one, and he is going to win or die.
Mm-hmm.
Which, unfortunately, there's a middle path there, Stannis, which is being forced to retreat by your men screaming.
Yeah.
If it was up to him, he would have won or died.
Yeah. Instead, he lost and lived. Okay, Cersei sees Sansa praying and asks what she's praying for. She doesn't really want to know. She just wants Sansa to drink with her so she can scare her with stories of what will happen to the women if Stannis takes the city.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this scene is meant to reinforce the foreboding feeling you have, the impending doom coming for them. And I think it's really effective.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, Cersei has this very cynical but accurate view of women's place in this world that, you know, in her estimation, women have two weapons to use against the men that rule the world: tears to make them feel bad, and their vagina to make them feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what a woman does. And you know, then the way she starts talking about all these women, you know, getting raped, and the way the men behave during a sack of a city,
mm-hmm.
You can tell that, like, this is so... I mean, Sansa got a taste of this on the streets of King's Landing the other day, but
yeah,
this is just super real. And
this time,
and
the Hound won't be able to save her.
Right.
There is no force in King's Landing, once the walls fall, that can save them.
In fact, you start to appreciate that Sir Ilan Payne... the Lannister henchman is there to slaughter them all to prevent them from facing that fate.
Yeah.
So not only will you not have a protector, you'll have essentially a living suicide pill.
Mm-hmm.
And again, she's, you know, like, there's this constant urge to have Sansa drink, which reminded me a little bit of, like, the episode in Breaking Bad where Walter White forces Walt Jr. to drink until he gets thrown. It was like that kind of, like, bullying behavior by an adult to... is grappling with something that they should, you know, instead of being the rock for the child, they're just, like, you know, using the child as a punching bag, and it's uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, and I actually got the impression the first time through that maybe Cersei had put the essence of Nightshade into the wine already.
Right.
And that this was the moment where their fates were sealed.
I think on first time through, you're supposed to, as she keeps on saying, drink, you're supposed to realize that, yeah, and you're you know... I mean, like I said, as you talk about all this first time experience, like, man, you're right. They do a lot in this episode to make you think that, oh, this could be the end for several characters.
Yeah, for all of the Lannisters.
And, you know, as we've seen in Game of Thrones, like, that's its charm, is that, like, for the most part, you can't say that anyone is really safe.
No.
And if someone's the good guy, then they're probably going to die. And if someone's the bad guy, they're probably going to die. And sometimes they're just minding your own business trying to... sit on the fence, you die.
Right now, the only person who's safe, I think, is Rob. Rob and his men are up in the north. They're nowhere near King's Landing. They're pretty safe at the moment.
Yes.
Because Tywin's
also,
on the other way.
Also, and that's the thing, like, you know, Tywin deciding to do this stroke, to, like, kind of abandon the field for Rob to fall back and defend the city is, mm-hmm. you know, despite all Tyrion's cunning and bravery, that's what saves the day.
It is.
Because
yeah.
Stannis absolutely, like, would have won had it not been for that.
Yeah, all Tyrion did was buy the time for Tywin to get there.
So, yeah. Now, you wonder at the end of this episode, will Tyrion be rewarded now that his mm-hmm. father's here, who, you know, he's... Tyrion isn't the hand of the king. He's acting hand of the king,
yeah.
keeping the seat warm for his father. What's his father going to do? What
Good
kind
question.
Of recognition will he get for his meritorious service?
Uh-huh. So Stannis boats are landing on the shore. Tyrion tells the archers to hit him with flaming arrows. That takes care of a bunch of them, but they manage to make it to the Mudgate anyway, where the Hound and his men fight them. I love the scene with the Hound where he goes down there and... He tells the archers, if anybody shoots me with a flaming arrow, or shoots anywhere near me with a flaming arrow, I'll strangle you with your own guts.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I just love the Hound.
I also, Tyrion's line about, as he sees Stannis just rowing through all this wildfire, completely exposed to these flaming arrows, he's like, that Stannis is a serious man.
Yeah.
And he, boy, is he.
I mean, Stannis doesn't bother to let his men go first at this point.
Right, that's
he's on the front line. He's the first man up the ladder. He's the first man on the shore.
And you're supposed to, I mean, and I think you do see the difference between him and Joffrey and even Cersei, like how they view the reason he's such a good military commander, other than his grasp of tactics and strategy, is because he is able to inspire his men. And he does that through a lot of foolhardy bravado. But he knows this is a desperate situation. Like, if he had not lost all of his fleet and so many men, I don't know that he is on the front lines.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that wouldn't be the smart thing to do. But now, where the odds are so even and this is all standing on the edge of a blade, he knows, like, if I'm not there and like leading, if I'm not leading this suicide charge, then nobody is going to fight as hard, or they might not even do it. So, like, this, he's maximizing his chances for victory. With a new set of circumstances. I thought that's cool. And it also shows that, like, yeah, people haven't just been bullshitting about Stannis being being good at this.
Yeah.
He deserves his reputation for being a fierce, tough man.
Yeah, and you can also see the contrast, but also the similarities between, like, Tyrion and Stannis, because they're both using the tools that they have. Stannis is not a man who delivers flowery speeches to motivate his troops. He simply charges ahead and leads by example. Tyrion, on the other hand, while he is courageous in very similar ways, he is able to rouse the troops with speech, you know?
Right.
Which is one of my absolute favorite scenes in Game of Thrones. I think the speech he delivers is awesome.
The brave men at the gate speech?
Yeah. It's great, but we'll get there. Cersei tells Sansa about how Robert treated her after she became queen, and it's not great. She instructs Shay on how to curtsy and begins picking away at her background, where she spots some holes in her tail and asks Shay to tell the whole thing. But Lance will bust into Cersei to tell Cersei how poorly the battle is going before she can, you know, sniff out Shay's background. And Cersei tells him, pull Joffrey back into the Red Keep, and then she sits down with Sansa to tell her why Aelyn Payne is really here, to kill them if Stannis takes the city.
Yeah, so there again, we just talked about the difference between Joffrey and Stannis, and how, like, Joffrey talks such a big game.
Yeah.
And then he's such a craven coward. And even then, his mother tells him to do this, and Lancel relays the message. But it was up, like, no one's going to make the king flee the battlefield. And everyone's saying, like, the Hound is saying, Tyrion's saying, even Lancel is on the side of, like, if you run, the men are going to fight. Why should they?
Yeah.
And Joff takes off anyway,
because
he's a fucking coward.
Coward is at its finest. I don't know how much more we want to say about Shay. I think we talked about that stuff earlier.
We can move on.
Okay, we go back to the fighting. Bronn saves the Hound when a man on fire rushes at him, causing him to freeze up. And the Hound decides he's going to pull his men back in behind the walls, because he's pretty shaken by it. And Stannis goes over the walls with ladders, and he is the first one up there. I don't know how he makes it. But...
We skipped over this thing about where a rock hits the dude's head that's standing right beside him and just splashes his face with blood. Uh-huh. And it maybe staggers him for like a quarter of a second, but he's like, you know, bellowing for ladders just a minute later. And again, the first guy up on the wall.
Yeah.
He's a monster, and so is the Hound. Like, the Hound cuts a man in half.
Yeah, it's awesome.
with one swing, an armored man in half. It's nuts, like, how unstoppable he is until this fire, like, puts the fear of him, and he starts getting that PTSD, and things are going blurry, and, like, he's starting to see he can feel the heat off the fire, even though it's not necessarily anywhere near him, and the man on fire rushing him. You know, this is all stuff that we knew about the Hound, and we're seeing all these weaknesses play out. And it's going to drive him to do some rash things.
Have we seen Bronn's archery skills before on display?
I don't think so.
Because he's pretty good here.
I mean, he hit a football-sized target from a couple hundred yards away.
Well, he hit this guy through the eye, too, as he was charging at the
Hound. Right. Yeah.
Pretty good shot. I don't know how far away he is. It's hard to tell, but...
Right. You're right. That's a hell of a shot.
Yeah. So kudos to Bronn for saving the Hound.
He's just a ace at martial skills. And the fact that, like, Bronn gives him kind of the friendly nod after he does it. Cause he's like, bygones. You didn't kill me over our little, I don't know, horse spat. So everything's cool. See, I saved your life, big guy.
And also, like, see, I'm just as serious about this stuff as you are.
Right.
Like, we both enjoy killing. We are very similar. You just can't get off it, man.
Yeah, your problem is, hey, I'm killing dudes, and I was singing, whoring, and drinking before right. I did. You were just feeling sorry for yourself. So,
yeah.
Who's the better one? It's kind of like the Greeks always debate that about the Spartans. Like, okay, yeah, Spartans right. are all fierce in battle, but, you know... Yeah, and we're just philosophers, and we say, but like, you know, we live happy lives and then still go and fight our wars, so fuck those guys. Braun's definitely not the Spartan.
No, definitely. He's a Roman. So the Hound is guzzling wine. Tyrion scolds him for coming back behind the walls, but he doesn't care. He says, fuck everybody, fuck King's Landing, fuck the king, which probably... Not a great decision if you decide to stay in King's Landing, but we see later on he doesn't.
And there's nobody can stop him.
No,
the king, the Kingsguard, none of these guys.
So Stannis begins ramming the gates, and Lancel pulls Joffrey back to the keep over Tyrion's protests. Tyrion sees how low the morale is, and he decides to lead the attack himself, and he delivers a hell of a speech to get his men to follow him back into battle. And they come around. Like, those are brave men out there. Let's go fuck them in the ass, essentially.
Yep.
Pretty good. Pretty good speech.
Yeah,
one of my favorite scenes.
Especially since he's just improvising. And you see...
Yeah.
You can kind of see, like, him wild-eye looking. And he's like, I'll lead the attack. Like, yep. He plays it like a man who can't believe these words are coming out of his mouth. And, like, mm-hmm. he gets off the thing and he's handed his axe and the helm. And, like, his eyes are wild, like... You know, shit, I guess my feet are going to take me to do this thing, and everyone's following me.
And he's the only one who can. And I wonder if Varys' words are ringing in his ears at this moment about him being the only man who can save them. Because he's just lost everyone who potentially could. The Hound has noped out. Lancel
right.
has taken Joffrey off to hide.
Right.
There is no one else.
And the men saw it. And the
yeah.
men saw it.
And they don't want to follow Tyrion. They don't want to fight anymore.
No.
Because
this is all like this pays off the other stuff where they were walking through the city and they heard everyone talking about the murderous little monkey. Like mm-hmm. he knows that this is what the men think, so he's got to dig deep to find some motivation, and it kind of miraculously he does.
Yeah, and I like how he uses his smaller stature to not shame them.
Kinda.
I mean, sort of.
And Putin, like, look at me, and, like, I'm only a half man, but I'm going yeah. out there to battle, so what's that make you? Less than a half man.
Yeah.
Hey,
I guess they feel the shame in that moment. Sure.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, I'm not saying it's right, but it's a well-mined, like, the White Feather campaign of World War One. Like, you insult a man's courage, and it tends to get their blood up, because...
It's reverse psychology.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the patriarchy swinging the other way.
You guys, even if you wanted to, you couldn't stop Stannis. I mean, Stannis, look at him. Look
right.
how tough he is.
Right.
There's nothing you could do.
Yeah, it's just all a bunch of girly men.
Right. So then we go to Lancel telling Cersei that the battle is lost, and he wants to escort Joffrey back to the battle so that he can hopefully get his men back on board. Cersei knocks him down and then goes into the other room, and Sansa... is there to kind of calm the other women. Shay sends Sansa away, knowing that she, you know, has a chance to escape here, potentially. I don't know. She goes to her chambers where the Hound is hiding, and he says he's going away, and he offers to take Sansa with him to take her back to Winterfell, and she turns this down for some unknowable reason. This is so fucking stupid.
Oh, only in retrospect. Because, again, she thinks that she's going to be fine when Stannis wins, and Stannis should win. And she's afraid of the Hound. This guy is a drunken guy who gives her speeches about how much he likes killing. And, yeah, while he's in his cups, he's offering me help. But when we're on the long road to Winterfell...
No, this is the guy who saved her from being raped for no apparent reason.
Yeah, but I also think that it's unrealistic to think that Sansa is going to see the Hound offering her to fight his way through King's Landing and out of it and take her to Winterfell is the safe option. Like, she chose wrong for sure. But from her point of view as a 14-year-old girl terrified of this very scary man who's, again, very drunk and who's covered in blood.
Who, again, saved her from being raped just episodes ago.
Yeah, but why? Like, but here's the thing. Why does Sansa think he did that? Because he's a good guy? Because he immediately said, don't think this is because I'm a good guy. I just like killing. Mm-hmm. And when he tried to thank her, like, he just gives the scariest speech possible. And he's Joffrey's dog, so for as far as she knows, he was acting on orders, and these orders are consistent with my idea of, like, I love killing people. So I said it again. Yeah, it's really easy to criticize all of Sansa's decisions. Obviously, she's wrong. She should have gone with the Hound.
Yeah.
Knowing how this battle turns out. But if she'd stayed barred in her room and Stannis did win, I do think it's entirely possible that she would be in a very strong position, because Stannis does not wish her well. In fact, she's a hostage that he can use to get concessions from Rob, because he wants the whole kingdom. And, you know.
Sure, but I wonder. I can't imagine that it will be very easy for her to escape Stannis' men. Just in general, like the ransacking of the city is not going to be Stannis walking and knocking on each door and saying, is someone of importance in here that I could maybe use?
Okay,
no, it's going to be his men rampaging through the city, killing and fucking everything in sight.
I think there will be some of that, but I think there's another thing we're supposed to understand is that this is essentially Cersei's propaganda, because that's what her father did.
Mm-hmm.
When he sacked King's Landing back when Jaime murdered King Aerys, and Tywin stormed the city and took over, he, you know, destroyed the former family. He had Gregor Clegane, like, slaughter the royal children and rape the prince's wife and all this stuff. She's projecting that on Stannis. I don't think Stannis would let his men go through. Like, he's a very disciplined commander, and he's very law and order. I mean, he's the guy who cut off Davos's fingers because he's a smuggler, and then promoted him to knight because he saved his life.
Yeah, but I think we're supposed to understand. Know that?
That's what Shay just told her.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, Shay, I think she trusts Shay at this point.
Okay.
I'm saying, like,
yeah,
I'm not saying it's
reasons.
Not stupid. I just think that, again, from a 14-year-old girl's perspective, this guy entering her room and being drunk as hell and covered in blood and scary and all the things he's told her have, like, if he had found an ounce of humanity in him after when she tried to thank him for saving her from being raped, this might have gone differently. But that's, again, part of the tragedy of the Game of Thrones.
All right, so Tyrion leads his men out to, as he said, fuck Stannis in the ass, which works actually a little too well, because Tyrion realizes too late that there are many more men on their way to fuck their own asses. One of the King's Guard turns on Tyrion during the battle and slashes his face before Podrick puts a spear through the guy.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking.
Yeah.
King's Guard coming after him.
Yeah, it seems like maybe the king has ordered that, potentially.
Could be.
Because I don't know why else you would take this moment where there's a ferocious battle raging to try and kill Tyrion.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mildly interesting mystery.
Okay,
sure. I think that I also like how Peter Dinklage plays this. Like, he's kind of like creeping up and inching up towards the guy. Like it looks like me trying to kill a spider, like a big spider with a newspaper.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, icky. And then he just cuts the dude's leg in half and has to kind of gingerly finish the guy off.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it works. Like, everyone's chanting the half men, and then you see this wave of men, and everything looks lost.
Yeah, Stannis has outmaneuvered him.
Yep. And he takes a wound to the face, which is not immediately obvious why it is incapacitating to him. Maybe he's just not used to getting cut in the face.
I'm not used to it.
It doesn't look like the blood loss would have done it.
No, it's like a trickle. It's not that bad.
I wonder if it had been better if it was, like, above his brow and, like, just a curtain of blood fell and got in his eye. And then, like, that would, I believe, would be a little bit more incapacitating. Would certainly look more gruesome, but...
Yeah.
The brutal reality is Tyrion's supposed to get a really fucked up scar in this battle and takes off his nose.
Hmm.
So he's just like this, got this skull-like visage for the rest of the series, and they just are not going to do that to Peter Dinklage. He's too handsome.
He still has his nose at the end of the scene, so
you know, it's a much, much worse vicious wound that he takes in the books.
The other thing that I really like in this scene is when Stannis cuts the top of that guy's head off.
Oh, Jesus. It's like, I forgot how Walking Dead this thing is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, there is just some top-notch gore.
There is, yeah. That guy got the curtain of blood in his eyes.
He got, yeah. That's the last thing he saw.
Mm-hmm. So we go to speaking of the last thing, the final scene, Cersei tells Rickon a story about the horrible stags and the wolves in the woods and how brave the lion cub was. All the while, it's sort of intercut with images of the battle. And she watches the throne room door, Essence of Nightshade in hand, ready to kill them both before Stannis can reach them. As Rickon's about to take the Nightshade, Tywin walks into the throne room to announce that the battle is over and they have won. It's a great scene.
Yeah, and if in case people are confused, because you see a Baratheon soldier cutting a swath through all of these, Stannis's men, that's Loras, who's wearing Renly's battle armor as a tribute to his former lover.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was kind of cool, but it was a little confusing because you have to figure out a whole lot of shit in this one reveal that, you know, the Tyrells have made a peace gesture to Tywin to join forces to repel Stannis because they hate Stannis. And
I didn't know about the Tyrell part. What's indicating the Tyrell?
Because Loras is here with all these men.
Okay, yeah. For some reason, I thought that was Lancel who walked in. They look so much alike.
No, Lancel walks in and
hiding,
Cersei
yeah.
punches him in the armpit where he took the arrow, yeah. and he starts just screaming. No, yeah, mm-hmm. it's Loras when he pulls off. As he strides in, he's got this like big white sash on, and he pulls off the helmet, which had those little cool stag things, and uh-huh. it's...
Yeah, and Tywin on the horse.
And then once you see that, then Tywin's right behind him. Like, oh, yeah, like I said, mm-hmm. you have to figure out a whole bunch of shit. And he says, yeah, we won.
They did. They won. And I guess Stannis was just dragged away screaming.
Yeah, he's very delusional. Like, because he does. He wants to die.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think he doesn't think he'll get another chance.
Yep.
With he's lost so many men, and he had this huge army that he won from the most part from his brother with that black magic, and it's all being taken away from him now.
And I feel like this is a really great scene for Cersei, because she
it really is.
You know, she gets to have a moment where we feel bad for her. Which are very few and far between in this show when it comes to Cersei.
Yeah, and the this would be a heroic scene were the Lannisters the good guys and they play it that way. Like the relief that floods over Cersei and she instantly pours out the poison and mm-hmm. and shatters it, and it's like because like it's this relief, and she probably doesn't want to know her father to think she weak,
uh-huh.
and she's about to poison herself. Maybe that's what Pycelle was trying to say. But it's, I am happy. I didn't want to see all those women, mass raped. I didn't want to see, Tommen have to die,
mm-hmm.
Cause he seems like a good lad. Tyrion likes him.
Yeah. I called him Rickon before. I fucked up his name. It's Tommen.
I didn't even notice. Yeah. It's Tommen. So, and then Tywin, like he looks very triumphant, and it's, we haven't seen Tywin triumphant for a while. He's gotten his ass handed to him again and again and again by Rob. That's been kind of his arc for the season. He's turned it all around in this one battle.
Yeah. And that's the end of the episode.
Yeah. Before we do feedback, I just wanted to talk about the Reigns of Castamere, because I think this is the first time it's been a big part. And, like, you know, what does it mean? This is a song composed as a tribute to Tywin Lannister, because we've talked about, as Tywin himself has talked about, his father, Tytos, had kind of ran the Lannisters into disrepair. He was, you know, Tywin said he's too loving and caring and weak. You know, there's a lot of personal defects to this man. But at the end of his life, the Lannisters were at a risk of losing their position as the paramount lord in the Westerlands. And these their rivals, their political rivals, the Castamires, whose sigil is also a lion. When Tywin started going around after his father's death and, like, accepting everyone's oaths of allegiance, this guy kind of big-timed him and said, like, you know, why should I have to bow and scrape and pay taxes to you when I'm a lion too, and my armies are just as powerful and strong as yours, and kind of like, you know, go get your shoeshine box, Tywin. to put it in a Goodfellas term. And Tywin responded by completely destroying this guy and pulling his castle walls down and putting his entire family to the sword, just to make the statement that I am not Tythos Lannister. I'm Tywin. God damn it. Mm-hmm. And they made the Reigns of Castamere, and that's now the official theme song for the Lannister family and their armies. There you go.
Right.
Hey, do you like Bald Move? You're listening to us right now. If you like Bald Move and you want more Bald Move, you want Bald Move faster, you want Bald Move without ad interruptions and digressions such as this one, well, I have got a product for you. It is called club.baldmove.com. Go there and we give you a pitch. We give you a description of all the special features, all the stuff about quips and Lunch with Jim and Aarons and first run movies and video game playthroughs and bonus audio content features and video features, all for a low monthly price. You can, or even lower quarterly price, or even lower yearly price. If you really want to just back us for 12 months, wouldn't that be nice? You can go to club.baldmove.com to get that. And hey, free 30-day trial by signing up. club.baldmove.com. Now we can get the feedback. Travis M., there's been some amazing episodes and intriguing characters throughout the run of Game of Thrones, no doubt. For me, though, there's been no better storyline that captures both of these elements than this episode. From the slow approach of Stannis' fleet to the quiet conversations and impatient atmosphere in King's Landing, the episode features the small moments and political machines or machinations that set Game of Thrones apart from all other shows, while featuring an epic spectacle in the Battle of Blackwater Bay. Extravaganza that we've come to enjoy in later seasons. You find yourself rooting for both sides in a siege and loathing them at the same time. Stannis killed Renly with blood magic and is somewhat under the influence of a red witch, but he leads from the front, and you know that he'll mount Cersei and Joffrey's heads on spikes, rule as a strong leader, and appoint Davos to the handship. Tyrion shines in this episode with his clever defense of the city and courage on the battlefield, but his victory means the survival of Cersei, Joffrey, and the rat-infested royal court. You're conflicted as the two armies crash, and you get a full potent dose of the moral grayness of George's world. I feel the best moments, however, are left for the Hound. His stare down with Bronn before their shared drink, his frightened eyes watching the flames consume men alive, his bring me wine yell, his fuck the king monologue, his little bird scene with Sansa, showcase the twisted torment that exists within the Hound. For the first time, it made me see him for what he truly is, a very sympathetic soul, a view which becomes more important with his future arc. Which I'll just leave it at that. All this makes the Blackwater the best episode thus far of the series. I mean,
yeah, I can't argue with that. It's always been one of my top episodes.
I feel like it's still top three.
Yeah,
even this late, even in this late in the series, certainly top five. And the first thing that said, you know, Game of Thrones can deliver more than just sex position and titillation and intellectual stimulation of like court politics and intrigue. It's got this in it. They can tell a story this big and this kind of grand and not have a problem filming action that's complicated and hard to follow. And they've got the budget and they got the skill to do it. It really was a statement episode. Carolee from UConn, Oklahoma, isn't Roz's necklace from Tyrion? We had a question about this previous episode. He gave it to Roz when he was using her services in Winterfell in season one. Theon notices her wearing it when he is with her. That's probably why Cersei thought it was Roz. A lot of people sent in that correction. I just did not remember the scene with Theon. And Roz stuff is always a little bit foggy because she's a show character. So like stuff that I see in the show that then, or I read in the books, I see in the show is like reinforced, and when there's a conflict, it's not. So, again, this is a remix of a lot of different book plots to put the show character Roz in a situation that a book character is in, and I got confused. I apologize. Luke D., hey, Aaron, wondering if you could be do something for those of us who have listened to the podcast for years. Could you throw in a mildly interesting somewhere in the podcast as a nod to your references in later ones? I miss hearing it. Well, if you were listening real sharp, Luke, you already got your wish.
Sure did.
Liz A., I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I see our resident superstar, George R.R. Martin, pretty regularly around town, at the grocery store, at his movie theater, or driving down the road
through
near my
his
parents'
windows
house.
At night.
With my 50X binoculars, with night vision. A few weeks ago, my partner and I were listening to your podcast on a rare kid-free date night as we drove to the concert. We're not book readers, and when you discussed the names of Planetos and Southeros, we found it hilarious.
Yes.
Once we arrived at the venue, we would tell one another we're heading to the bathroom Eros or the bar Eros and so on. I was cracking one of these dumb jokes, and I turn around, and who is standing behind me but Germ himself?
No.
I was too intimidated to speak to him. Who knows what he thought or even if he overheard, but I couldn't help being charmed by the whole scenario. Awesome. Later, we had the opportunity to watch him dance to Wilco, and now my partner and I have our own dance move called the called German. I need someone to demonstrate what it is to do the German. So we have a story. Do you remember our buddy Peter?
Mm-hmm.
He went to George at Gen Con and kind of talked shit to his face because of something I said back in the day. I'd said something like, Germ has ripped off a lot of JRR's Tolkien stuff. In fact, even the RR. Like I had this joke where I'm like, I don't believe George R.R. Martin actually. I don't think he has an R.R. in his middle name. I think there's no fucking way a guy is born and decides to write like a critique slash takedown slash better version of Tolkien's work and actually has the same pretentious R.R. British stuffy professor name. No fucking way. And Peter essentially asked him that, like, Is your RR stuff just ripping off Tolkien? And like, and Martin was kind of offended by it.
Really?
And which I guess because number one, if you don't know Peter, he always frames stuff in the biggest asshole way that you can. He can't help himself.
Yeah.
And also, like, yeah, I mean, I guess it could be funny as a joke, like if you put it that way. But yeah, it really pissed Martin off.
Yeah, depending on how you say it. It could be either funny or insulting.
Yeah. I wonder what he would say if, like, he overheard someone making, like, obvious Game of Thrones meta jokes. I guess I'd probably feel good.
I would think so. I mean, it's to, like, inspire that in people.
Yeah, like there's people are having this random conversation and having fun at my material's expense. I think it would feel good. It wouldn't feel like an attack, like, your fake-ass middle name that's just a pretentious allusion to J.R.R. Tolkien.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, thanks for telling us that, Liz. And we do. I need to get a description, if not a video, of you guys German. Or better yet, Germ himself Germing.
Yeah.
Because it's got to be like some kind of Elaine dance from Seinfeld, right?
Right, yeah.
Or maybe it's like
involves like a lot more suspenders.
Yeah. Or maybe the guy is like smooth like Usher on the dance floor.
Yeah, holy shit.
He's just like doing all this weird technical breakdowns and, you know, it's pivots and spins. And uh-huh. I could also get down with knowing that. Okay. I think that's it for the non-spoiler feedback. As always, if you'd like to send feedback onto the show, we got one more episode. Do you think we'll do a wrap-up podcast? I don't feel like we will on the off-season stuff.
I don't think we'd do that on the rewatches.
So we got one more episode of Game of Thrones to discuss. If you'd like to send us feedback before we sign off until next year, do so at gameofthrones@baldmove.com. You can also get on our forums and discuss whatever you want about Game of Thrones or other things that fall within the acceptable rules of our forum.
Mm-hmm.
You can't advocate for the violent overthrow of the government. You can't share pornography. You can't share illegal content. There's a couple things. I just don't want to make it like anything. I don't want the hound to show up and be all like, fuck the king, all right? Mm-hmm. But you can go to forums.baldmove.com and discuss it there. Follow us on social media. Keep your ear to the ground at baldmove.com for new stuff. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Without further ado, let's get to the spoiler section.
All right, we're back with spoilers.
Have any nuggets?
Yeah, I thought it was kind of funny when Bronn was talking about, you know, how the Hound has a size advantage, but he's smaller and faster. He's got speed, and then we see what happened with the Mountain and Oberyn, right?
Yeah.
Later on, I think it's season four. The Clegane's are definitely intimidating, but they can be beaten by smaller, faster people. Certainly.
Yeah, you don't want to monologue over what you think is incapacitated Clegane.
That's a bad way to go.
And I hope, should we ever be graced with the glory that is the Clegane Bowl, hallowed be its name, that fucking Sandor doesn't forget that.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear any long, like, oh, the brazier's on the other face. No, I just end it. End it, please.
He's not one for many words. I don't think he would get in there.
No, it doesn't seem like a monologuer, but no. I just don't want him to go out like that.
However, if this fight had taken place between the Hound and Bronn, you know Bronn would have monologued afterward.
Right.
You know it.
Right.
He gets the Hound down on the ground and he starts mouthing off, and the Hound's going to grab him and throw him in the fire.
Right. I thought it was interesting how when Tyrion chides Shay about, look, you can't fuck your way out of everything, she's like, well, it worked so far. And I felt like that was a little bit of a portent towards season four when, you know, Tyrion's head is halfway in the noose. She tries to fuck herself out of the situation she's in.
Yeah.
Turns over state's evidence on Tyrion and then starts sleeping with his father, which ultimately dooms her. But it's like, she's going to either try to the knife her way out or fuck her way out.
And I don't know if that knife would have done a damn thing.
I mean, it would have probably killed the first man tried.
The first one, yeah.
And then, you know,
then the eight behind him probably would have got her.
Or they're enraged and they kill her. Like, I just feel like she wasn't, I don't know. I don't know. I'd be rooting for her.
I just always think she's delusional, like with her place in this whole thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no.
She's delusional about how little of a threat she sees pretty much everywhere.
So I keep coming back to, like, does Shay really care about Tyrion? Does she care about Tyrion the way the average sex worker cares about her client? Like, there might be a connection there. She has affection for him, but...
No, I think she cares more for him, and that is betrayed later on by all the stuff, you know, with Tywin. It's, you can tell that that definitely takes a toll on her. It's not something she did.
And in the show, they really make a point out of Tyrion kind of like alienate her, like Old Yeller style. Like he does everything but pick up a rock and throw it at her and be like, "Get out of here, Shay!" Get as he's wiping tears from his eyes. Like it removes any kind of shades of gray from her character, and it's like, I don't know what to think. I still not a huge fan of her character. The season didn't do anything to kind of like sway me from that, except for I did. That's the thing. Like, I kind of want to hate her character because I just don't think she's executed very well. But when she sticks up for Sansa, when she helps Sansa escape almost certain death at the hands of Sir Ilyn Payne, when she, you know, has got a dagger strapped to her leg because she's gonna stick the first few Baratheons that come to try to take advantage of her, it's hard not to like her a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because she's tough.
We also do have like another, I think it's another full season of Shay like not fucking getting it, right?
Right.
And Tyrion trying to push her away, trying to talk about the threat now two that Tywin's
seasons.
Back.
Two seasons.
Yeah, that, it's like mid-season four or something.
It's like after the trial, after the trial by combat, after like it's the penultimate or very last episode of season four where he, Tyrion finally confronts and kills her.
Yeah, I think it's like mid-season four where Tyrion goes on trial, which I view as like the turning point.
Okay.
Where Shay, like, it's no longer matters whether or not Shay gets the point because Tywin has turned her at that point.
Right.
So, yeah, it's like a season and a half more of this back and forth between Tyrion and Shay.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know why we blame Shay more than Tyrion, because Tyrion's fundamentally the one that has a lack of maturity. He could have, at any time, Bronn grab her, bind her, throw her on a boat, and have her taken to Lys or wherever.
Yeah.
And he doesn't because he needs her in a very real way to prop up his esteem and his image and kind of like, you know... and it's just, you know, he knows that's not good for him politically. We know it's not good for him... as far as, you know, being able to play the game, but he does it anyway. And yeah, it seems like we're always like fuck Shay, but it's Tyrion the one that's got the real control here and the power in the relationship, and he just refuses to do anything about it.
Yeah, but I also blame Shay for not understanding the true trouble that they're in here, the true danger.
Yeah.
Because if she did, I think she would understand that now is not the time for this. And we could be together later, but now... is a time for being very, very cautious.
All right. Kyle Y. from Washington. Hey, guys, I have a question for each of you regarding your Battle of the Blackwater episode. Aaron, given your book knowledge, which parts of the battle from the books that didn't make it on screen did you miss the most? One, the raiding of the Kingswood by Tyrion's Mountain Clans.
What?
So he's referring to, remember that, like, this Tyrion, beginning season, brought, you know, Shagga, son of Dwarf or whatever, and all the other burnt men. And
you see them, like... They're, here and there sporadically through the season.
But then they disappear after like the third episode. Yeah. After I think the last time you see him is when they go grab Grandmaster Pycelle and cut his beard off.
Uh-huh.
In the books, as Stannis Men gets closer, Tyrion dispatches them to the Kingswood. So if they find any Baratheon spies or if Stannis tries a land attack, he's got this vicious band of killers that's prowling the Kingswood and disrupting them. The Bridge of Broken Ships, this is where there's all this wreckage that Stannis has to use to, like, you know, we played the board game Battles of Westeros, which is this fantasy flight two-player, what would you call that?
Strategy
game. Yeah. Where you resolve everything in dice, you got little miniatures, and we play soldier. And in that, like, the Blackwater is just clogged with ships, and you can move your men across it to form, like, a makeshift land bridge. And that part of the books happens. In fact, Tyrion goes down while he's fighting on that kind of broken terrain. And the Kingsguard, Podrick doesn't stick a spear through his head. The Kingsguard, after Pod attacks him, loses his balance and falls into water, and his plate armor just takes him to the bottom and he drowns.
Uh-huh.
The chain, which we've talked about before, this is Tyrion's masterstroke. Let all of Stannis' fleet come in, raise a chain behind them so it's like 3 or 4 foot above the water so they can't escape, and then they set the entire bay on fire, which does just devastate Stannis' fleet, and that's my favorite part. He also mentions Joffrey flinging the antler men with trebuchets. They don't mention this in the show, but there's 3 giant trebuchets in the books called, I think, Stannis' Whores. Or maybe they're called Joffrey's Whores, but they're named that because they're going to royally fuck Stannis. Mm-hmm. And there's been all these men who have been trying to secretly work behind the scenes to help Stannis with the invasion. They call them Antler Men because they're for the Baratheons.
Yeah.
And Joffrey finds out about them, and he nails antlers onto their head and then launches these guys at Stannis' army from trebuchets. Because that's sound military tactics.
Yeah.
But I think there's even kind of a weird, almost Hitchhiker Guide from the Galaxy kind of sequence where Tyrion or someone else is out fighting, and there's like a naked man with horns on his head that splatters on the ground in front of him. I like the chain. Which of those 4 missing scenes, he wants to know for your questions, sounds the coolest and or most feasible to film for television?
Oh, the chain definitely sounds the coolest. I think it's like a really good tactical move.
Yeah.
That kind of, I don't know, I almost felt like they did too much damage to Stannis' fleet as is.
Right.
To where I thought he didn't have as many men as mm-hmm. he would ever need to take the city at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So if they had put the chain up behind him and just burned essentially the entirety of his fleet, I really would have felt like there's Stannis is just done. There's no way he can take this city now. So
that's because like there again in the books there is a land invasion component. So
okay.
The fleet was going to come in and secure the bay and then ferry them in across, and the wildfire made it to where that's just a much, much more treacherous and slow and hard. So, I mean, gotcha. I thought they adapted everything very well, and maybe that's why they didn't include the chain. I heard someone said they didn't have the time for it, or they didn't think they could do the CGI expense, but
yeah,
that's a lot of complicated shit to stage when they told the same story without the chain and you didn't have the land component of the battle. And
yeah.
So,
and it also, I felt like there was a certain desperation in the landing, in the show,
right,
that maybe wouldn't have been there if they had planned to land. I wouldn't have felt like, okay, well, this is the audible that Stannis is calling now that his fleet is totally screwed.
I mean, it would have been an interesting spectacle for men to scramble over all these burnt and broken ships.
It would have been, yeah.
And it's like just unstable and men falling and drowning. Like I think it would have felt a lot more, I guess, storming of Normandy kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have been very hard to pull off.
It feels like more of like a season 5 kind of thing.
Yeah, I think maybe
as far as budget and time goes.
Maybe the antler men would have been good, because instead of Joffrey just impatiently asking, "Where are my ships? Where are my ships?" it would have given him something sadistic but useless to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And then kind of sell the story that as soon as the spectacle was done and he was no longer having fun launching his helpless men, then he retreated from the battlefield with cowardice.
Mm-hmm.
But having him there by Tyrion's side also kind of gave them a good moment. So
yeah.
Yeah, I guess I would like to see the chain, but I understand that would have a lot more differences than just adding the chain, as we discussed, and the antler men, I think, would have been better from a storytelling perspective. All right, Andrew S., who knows about Jon's resurrection outside of Davos and the Night's Watch or Free Folk? How would Sansa not know, for example? She's got there a pretty short time afterwards. I feel like it's safe to assume that one of the people at Castle Black would have mentioned it, even if Jon didn't. How did the Northern Lords not know? Wouldn't they question why Jon just bailed on the Night's Watch and took on the Boltons? Doesn't the North take his Night's Watch vows very seriously? I guess I just feel in general that the show skipped over Jon's resurrection quickly once it actually happened. He's magically resurrected, Tormund makes the dick joke, he kills some dudes, and then everybody besides Davos forgets about it. Why isn't this a bigger part of the story? Damn fine question. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, it does feel a little weird that nobody is talking about this. And I think it's something we've mentioned on the show before,
mm-hmm.
In the ensuing season. But yeah, a lot more people should know about it, and a lot more people should be talking about it.
I do think there's a difference in the books and the show. I do feel like the books are going to explore that, and you know, because that's something that Martin has made clear, that you can't come back to life unchanged. Mm-hmm. And John paid a little bit of lip service to that in season six, mm-hmm. but now it's that's completely been forgotten about, to streamline it. So I think you're going to have to wait with when and if the books come out to get that kind of like satisfying John wrestling with his kind of zombie nature, because they're just not interested in exploring that in the show. And probably because at the end, I mean, that tells me, and you know, maybe I'm being foolish for putting too much stock in it, but that tells me that that aspect is going to be an interesting character moment, but it's not really going to impact the plot. Hmm. Like, it's not like John's going to turn into some undead, remorseless killing machine and betray everything at the end. I don't think.
Hmm.
Now watch you do that, and then I'll be, like, super angry about it next year, but that's not how I think it's going to go. Jason M., I love Game of Thrones, and I love Jon Snow as a character. He's the humble hero we've all fallen in love with, and know that he will ultimately be the one to save all of Westeros. However, in my opinion, he's the whole reason everyone is in the shitstorm to begin with. You ready for this, Jim?
Sure.
If Jon wouldn't have pranced around Westeros crying White Walker, they wouldn't have breached the Wall, and Dany might be sitting on the Iron Throne. The White Walker's only hope is to get a dragon, otherwise they would be wandering aimlessly in the north with no possible way to breach the Wall. The Wall was created to keep the White Walkers out and sealed with magic. There's no other means in which the White Walkers could have made it through. I don't know that that's an assertion based in evidence. We don't know of any other way
sure.
that they could break through, but we also did not know of the dragon loophole.
Mm-hmm.
The books have hinted that there's a horn that could blow it down. There's an open question of whether the dead could just scale the Wall. There's a question of whether the dead could, with their cold powers and enough time and determination, freeze the bay and walk around the Wall. You know, obviously the Wall is a great deterrent, but I don't know that we know that it's completely a foolproof way to keep out the dead. Because else, why do you need sure. the Night's Watch? If the Wall is just going to do, and the dead can do whatever they want, why the hell do you have to have men defending the Wall? Why was that an institution that went back to the Long Night?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I feel like, it, you know, having seen The Matrix,
I can't wait to see how you bring this around.
The question is, did John have any choice in the matter, essentially? Like, has right. the Night King foreseen something that tells him the dragon is coming, and that's why he started amassing his armies?
Right.
Because the Night King has been amassing armies.
Mm-hmm.
If the Wall were an impenetrable barrier that he had no way to get past, what good is amassing an army?
To what end?
Yeah. So that tells me that either the Night King has foreseen something, or the Night King has another means of breaching the Wall when he chooses.
Yeah, and I think either one of those, like the fact that he has foreseen it and this is a prophecy, and that, or not Nessa prophecy, but a vision he's had similar to the things
right.
that the Three-Eyed Raven has.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're kind of on the mark there. So it's you're right. It's like one of those questions of if John knew, if John had known about that, could he have done anything to prevent it? Whatever action he took that he thought would be the way to keep them from having the dragons would have led dragons to being in their hands.
Right.
He continues, let him finish his thought here, Jason. John's fear that the White Walkers led him to Dany, which disrupted her campaign and prevented her from taking the Iron Throne. This resulted in John handing over one of her dragons to Night King, causing the doom of Westeros. Well, I mean, I don't think Westeros is doomed yet. Had John just relaxed and enjoyed being king in the North, Dany would have destroyed Cersei, and they may have both ended up together under better circumstances. The other thing is, like, what if John hadn't done this and Dany gave in to her darker impulses and torched King's Landing? It might have prevented her from being the good queen that we want her to be. She could have been like another evil Targaryen and the realm's right back. So it's like, again, some of this stuff might have happened for a quote unquote reason.
Mm-hmm.
And if John had done like just chilled in King, like chilled in Winterfell and like essentially put his fingers in his ear and went la la la, you're saying that everything would have worked out, when it's just as likely Dany would have taken King's Landing with blood and fire, which would have been a big setback for the realm, and then she would have been completely ignorant to the designs of the White Walkers, and if they were able to breach the Wall, been completely defenseless to stop them.
And they would have had the time to amass an even larger unstoppable army.
Right, right. Cause, and they also would have marched that, assuming they could have gotten through the wall, they could have, you know, marched through all the north and continued to add to their forces and continued to add to their forces. I don't know. Like I said, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that John could have just sat things out.
I feel like we need Bran to get involved.
Plus,
it'd
been hella boring.
It would
hella
have been, yeah.
boring for him just being like, it's, I'm the king of the north, the king of the north. And
every
and,
scene he comes back.
Yeah, and then we get his couple scenes of Dany burning King's Landing, mm-hmm. and she's like, I'm the evil queen. It's like, it's a fucking halfway to being a shitty Broadway musical. That's not Game of Thrones.
No. I feel like Bran is doing a huge disservice to the realm right now, not getting mixed up in this stuff. Because
sure.
if anybody can see what's going to happen and what is currently happening, it's him. He needs to do something.
Well, I think he's first.
He's trying.
Yeah, I don't think he's mastered his powers, and he.
But
also,
come on, Bran, you're the only guy. Like, get good.
Yeah, and he hasn't mastered his powers, and he also one of his first taste of using his powers. He did some horrifying time loop that
killed
one of
his best friend.
Exactly. Yeah. So he's a little gun shy, and not good at his powers. Benjamin D. At this point, why would you take anything from the show as a projection for the books? He's taken to issue the statements I've made repeatedly in the last few weeks about one of the reasons I'm enjoying watching the show is I'm using that to try to figure out what is and isn't important in the books. I don't see any evidence that Dorne won't matter in the books. I don't even think it's reasonable to assume that Fagon theories and R plus L equals J theories are based on textual evidence. I mean, look, man. If you want to argue that the book and the show, despite everything the Double D's know from what George has given them, are going to bear no relation to each other, to the extent that you're going to quibble that R plus L equals J is not a done deal, I mean, you're so far off, in my estimation. It does not make you a bad person. It does not make you stupid or wrong. But in my estimation, from my worldview, you are so far off the reservation that I don't even know what kind of useful dialogue we could have. Because everything I would say, you're going to dismiss. And if you want me to entertain R plus L equals J theories alternatively, when the preponderance of the evidence in the books points to that direction, and oh, by the way, the show has confirmed it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's kind of magical thinking in my book.
Yeah, I always go back to the people who have the most information from George Martin about how he wants to conclude this story
right.
are the people who are making this television show.
Right.
And it's certainly within their prerogative to say, you know what, George, we think we have a better ending.
Sure.
And for them to go totally off the reservation. But do you really think that's what they're doing?
No,
or
I don't.
Would they rather write to the satisfying end that George has himself outlined to them?
Yeah. Now, if you want to say, I doubt that the wall will be taken down by an ice dragon.
Sure, I can give you
plausible.
Some details, but
that's
the large, broad strokes are going to be roughly the same.
Like, is Jon going to go and try to capture a white to prove to Cersei?
No,
probably
not.
Is Stannis going to burn his daughter and win? Like I said, we can just like all the other seasons, you can quibble about, you know, whether they should have put the antler men in or whatever, but there's no way that, like, in a version of the show, mm-hmm. Stannis would have won and taken King's Landing.
Yeah.
Just like I don't think there's any version of the books that's going to have Jon not be the son of Rhaegar and Lyanna Targaryen.
Or like Ilaria sitting on the Iron Throne at the end. Like,
right.
It's just not going to happen.
Right. And he continues, like, you know, he talks about, like, that Martin has given, like, Euron these badass speeches, and, like, you wouldn't give badass speeches and magical horns for people that were going to go nowhere. But, you know, Doran gave that badass blood and fire speech, sent his son over there, married Dany, and he got burnt to a crisp by Dany's own dragons. Mm. Like, literally
yeah.
amounted to nothing but a pile of ash. So how can you say that someone gets a badass speech? You know who gave a lot of badass speeches? Ned. You know who gave a lot of badass speeches?
Rob. Yep.
You know who gave a lot of badass to his own ear speeches? But look, Joffrey. Like,
Stannis.
Sure.
He's not dead in the books yet.
Not dead in the books yet, okay. But, like, I don't think he's going to sit on the Iron Throne. So, like, I mean, lots of people have given badass speeches and then been summarily destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So, I, like I said, I don't know. I don't know what you're expecting to hear from me that would change your mind, and I don't know what you were expecting me to hear that would change mine, because you're just advocating that the Double D's have gone rogue and are deliberately trying
with
to...
With no evidence for it. That's the problem.
Yeah. In fact, all evidence on the major points pointing the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Because I never took seriously any alternate theories that R plus L equals J, and I feel like I was vindicated.
No.
I'm not like to reevaluate the position now. Moving on from Ben from Sacramento, the first and second scene from the epilogue. He wants to talk about jetpacking. Season 1, Episode 1, we jetpack from beyond the wall to the hills near Winterfell. According to everything I've found, the wall to Winterfell is something like 650 miles on the King's Road, and he was on foot. That journey would have taken him weeks to complete, yet he was apprehended by Stark soldiers in the second scene, so they jetpack from the start. All right. First of all, you don't know how long he was captured after he abandoned his post at the wall.
Right.
You don't know where the Starks, like, you can say for sure that was near Winterfell. Like, the Stark soldiers, Stark bannermen patrol the entire north. I mean, it's a big place, and I'm not saying, like, there's, like, one Stark man per square mile or whatever, but they got outriders, and they're riding around. I mean, they're looking for wildlings raiding up there. They capture this guy who's a black brother far, you know, outside of the Gift. They're probably going to take him to Winterfell, because that's what you do with criminals. That's up to the Lord to pass judgment on them. So, like, that is a very different situation than in these later seasons where we know that John is at the wall and he's got to get the King's Landing, and he says, we've got 5 days to do that or whatever. Or we know that several nights only have passed and John has been stuck in this, you know, frozen lake, and he sent a crow and then a dragon. Like there's jetpacking and there's jetpacking. Like, many of the first seasons, there wasn't a lot of evidence that said, hey, there could have been weeks or months elapsed between these scenes. Whereas we get further into the series, it seems like there are events that say, no, only so many days have passed. Mm-hmm. But that's the thing. Like, I hate getting caught in this argument, because until, like, the last season, I was the one saying, just chill on the whole jetpacking thing. Mm-hmm. It's not that big a deal. There's all this evidence of where you can, like, you know, excuse and look around and not call it jetpacking. It gets harder to do that, but I don't think jetpacking is what's killing season 7.
No.
I don't think season 7 was killed.
No.
I think season 7 was very good with some with unfortunate stumbles and silly plot.
Yeah. I will say, I think season 7 had maybe the biggest stumble of the whole series so far, in that John had a very, very stupid plan.
Yeah,
but you're right. I don't think it killed the season for me either.
I think that probably...
And that's not saying, like, a whole lot in a show that doesn't have many problems.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about, like, the Sand Snakes.
Right.
Like, the stuff
or
in Dorne.
In general, yeah.
Yeah, and that, essentially.
I didn't feel like Arya's House of Black and White plot was very satisfying. It got the job of
moving
them.
There was a thing with the
waif
and the stabbings and all that
kind of
stuff.
The end of the climax of that, I don't feel like they quite had nailed down.
Yeah. But, you know, for 7 seasons of a TV show, if you can point out 3 flaws, I think we're doing pretty good.
But, yeah, I'm going to try to really just get off of jetpacking going forward, because the damn show itself has said there's going to be a lot of jetpacking.
Yeah.
And... you know, Martin hasn't written a book, so we'll see if he can do better. We'll see if he can do better. But I'm kind of, like, over-talking about it at this point. He also has a question about Varys. Ever since Melisandre is introduced, we've seen that King's Blood has the power for the Red God's magic. Every blood sacrifice we've seen has involved King's Blood, Gendry, Stannis, Shireen, etc. So can we just assume that Varys has some sort of King's Blood in him? It only makes sense. His junk was burned, root and stem, and the Red God spoke a name in the blue flames. Now the kings we know of are the Baratheons, Targaryens, Greyjoys, and Starks. He was born in Essos, so he has to be a Blackfyre or Targ, right?
Hmm.
There is a lot of tinfoil-y type spoilers about Varys' identity. And I did, again, if you check out the tinfoil archive that's mentioned in every show notes of every Game of Thrones podcast we do, there is a thing on Varys theories.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also one on, like, potential Varys and Illyrio master plan. And one of those things says, there's a lot of things. People say that Varys actually isn't a eunuch. He's a woman. He's the wife of Illyrio. He is, like you said, a Blackfyre princess. It does make sense that there would be some royal blood. But also, you know, there's kings in Essos, too. Like, Princess Nymeria came from Essos, the people of the Rhoyonar. That's the famous conquering princess that the Arya gave her name to her wolf. And it's just like, we just don't have enough information to speculate. And I guess the smart money would be that if he is got royal blood, it would be some sort of Blackfyre Targaryen, because that seems like he's, you know, in league with the Golden Company, and he's trying to get this Targaryen, who, if Aegon is not a fake Targaryen, he's probably a Blackfyre Targaryen, which is, I guess, kind of the same thing from Dany's perspective.
Which Aegon?
The fake Aegon. Not Jon Snow.
No?
He's
no?
not Aegon. Okay. He is not Aegon. That's his slave name. Let us move on, Anastasia E. I know there's been a lot of recent discussion on the podcast about the Valonqar theory / who is going to kill Cersei, but I've been rereading the books and they came across something interesting. In Cersei's first chapter in Feast, she refers to Tyrion as my twisted little Valonqar during the moment of inner dialogue. She just finding out Tywin has been murdered. Do you think that Gurm is dropping hint for us, or do you think that Cersei is using this term for him based on her own interpretation of the prophecy? I'm curious to hear your thoughts. I think what you're seeing here is George introducing this term, and it's supposed to be a mystery. Because at the end of this chapter, there's this quote where one of the Kingsguard busts in after she's had this kind of nightmare and says, should I fetch you a cup of water? And she goes, it's blood I need, not water. Tyrion's blood, the blood of the Valonqar. The torches spun around her. Cersei closed her eyes and saw the dwarf grinning at her. No, she thought, I was almost rid of you, but his fingers had closed around her neck and she could feel them begin to tighten. Now, we have no idea what she's talking about any of this. And several other of her chapters contained this imagery of her being choked and Tyrion stalking her. And then much later in the book, they relay the story of Maggie's prophecy of the Maggie the Wood Witch's prophecy about the Valonqar. So I think what this is supposed to do is just pique your interest, because he reveals this term Valonqar. What the hell is the Valonqar? Does it mean dwarf? Does it mean this? And then we find out that... I think there's a part in a book where one of these mercenaries brings a head of a dwarf, and he's from Essos, and he throws the head of the dwarf at her and says, here's the head of your Valonqar, and that makes her like an electric shock go through her, because he's just using the Valyrian word for little brother, and then we get the prophecy. So it's the three-step Martin reveal, and it's supposed to be a mystery, and you're supposed to be intrigued, and as you get more information, it's satisfying sort of you. So I don't think he's trying to tell us anything other than the story in the most interesting way he thinks he can. So, and that's all the spoiler feedback we got. Again, okay. Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. If you'd like to ask me any other questions that don't involve that don't involve John not being the son of Rhaegar and Lyanna, or don't involve jetpacking, I'd be happy to entertain them. We have one more episode only for the rest of the year, and probably not another one until sometime in 2018 when we start considering season 3, which will complete our coverage. We'll have complete full coverage of Game of Thrones, well, until season 8 comes out, which
do. We'll probably be on the season 8 train,
I think. Yeah, I mean, we'll have to see what our schedule looks like.
Right.
You know, if it hits in the middle of Mr. Robot season, or what if Fargo season 4, like, how, you know, that's a tough choice. Should we do Game of Thrones?
And we don't know what else is going to be new, you know, in 2019 or whatever.
Oh yeah, they got the Dunkin' Egg. We have to get the Dunkin' Egg out early.
Yeah,
gonna be all over that Dunkin' Egg. That's the new. That's the new stuff. No, we will be back for season 8,
obviously,
and we will have coverage for season 3. Unfortunately, it's not going to be this year, because we've got just so much stuff going on.
It's a busy holiday season, and we're going to be announcing even more stuff coming up. So
indeed.
Stay tuned for that.
Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. If you'd like to get in on that, forums.baldmove.com. If you'd like to discuss it publicly with our fellow fans, follow us along on your favorite social media. And check out baldmove.com for all of your podcasting on pop culture needs. Until the last time for a good long while, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.